Greetings and welcome to Season 1, Episode 6 of That's What I Think, But I Could Be Wrong, Should Recreational Drugs Be Legal? My name is Todd Lorenz. This is my show. I drop a new episode every Thursday, first thing in the morning. I think cryptids exist that science should recognize. I don't think Lee Harvey Oswald had a thing to do with the murder of John F. Kennedy. I don't think we know the truth about what happened on 9/11. I think the United States should meddle in foreign affairs as little as possible. And I believe the vast majority of politicians are corrupt. But hey, that's just what I think. And I could be wrong.
That's what I think, but I could be wrong. That's what I thought when I wrote this song. I say what I believe and I say it's strong. That's what I think, but I could be wrong.
Hey, welcome. Thank you for listening. Thank you for streaming. Thank you for downloading. Thank you for supporting my show. If you have not given me a positive rating or review on your media of choice, please do so. It helps me expand and grow the show, which is both necessary and appreciated. The topic this week, well, might be a bit touchy for some, maybe more touchy than the one I covered last week, illegal immigration. I want to talk about whether or not recreational drugs should be legal or legalized. I'll tell you how I feel right up front, and then we'll explore some issues. I am in favor of all recreational drugs being legal. Yeah, I said all. I don't mean just marijuana. I mean crack, PCP, meth, cocaine, heroin, magic mushrooms, whatever, all of it. And you know why? Because as long as we've had human beings on this planet, they have sought to alter their consciousness by consuming what we now call drugs. Generally speaking, I'm not in favor of legalizing morality. Sometimes it's necessary. But in this case, this prohibition, and we'll get into prohibition, has become unnecessary and, in my opinion, damaging to our society. So let's go ahead and get into it. Let's start with a look at the history of drug use. As always, my references are documented on my show notes page at toddlorenz.com. I'll begin by establishing a timeline of sorts, and I have a couple of references, and there are going to be big gaps in the timelines. I'm not going to go over every entry, just a few things that strike me as particularly interesting. 50,000 years ago, there was a Neanderthal burial site in Iraq found to contain remains of the herbal stimulant ephedra. And Paleolithic cave art across Europe and Africa suggests artists had experienced hallucinogens, or possibly migraines. In 10,000 BC, we had the earliest agriculture, some evidence that the first crops included psychoactive plants such as mandrake, tobacco, coffee, and cannabis. In 7000 BC, betel seeds, chewed for their stimulant effects, are found in archaeological sites in Asia. 4200 BC, opium poppy seed pods, found in a burial site near Granada, Spain. 4000 BC, we get wine and beer making in Egypt and Samaria. 3000 BC, cannabis cultivation in China and Asia. Evidence of cannabis smoking in Eastern Europe. In 2000 BC, we get the earliest record of prohibitionist teaching by an Egyptian priest who writes to his pupil, quote, I, thy superior, forbid thee to go to the taverns. Thou art degraded like beasts, end quote. In 2000 BC, coca residues found in the hair of Andean mummies. 1000 BC, Central Americans erect temples to mushroom gods. 800 BC, distillation of spirits in India. 430 BC, Greek historian Herodotus records recreational cannabis smoking among the Scythian people of the Black Sea. 625 AD, Muhammad orders his followers to abstain from alcohol. 1450, widespread use of coca leaves by the Incas. 1475, Turkish law makes it legal for a woman to divorce her husband if he fails to provide her with coffee. Oh, man. Wow. In 1493, the use of tobacco is introduced to Europe by Columbus and his returning crew. 1525 introduces laudanum, or tincture of opium, into the practice of medicine. 1868, in the world's first piece of anti-drug legislation, the United Kingdom Poisons and Pharmacy Act makes it illegal to sell opium and other drugs without a license. In 1886, the recipe for Coca-Cola is patented. It includes coca leaves and caffeine-rich cola nuts.
In 1887, amphetamine is synthesized in Germany.
1906, coca leaves removed from the recipe for Coca-Cola. 1909, opium, smoking, criminalized in the United States. 1914,
Harrison Narcotic Act
places cocaine and opiates under stringent control in the United States. 1920 to 1933, we get prohibition. 1933, Swiss chemist Albert Hofmann synthesizes LSD and accidentally discovers its
hallucinogenic effects.
1951, U.S. tycoon Al Hubbard tries LSD and starts promoting its recreational use. 1967, LSD is made illegal. 1975, Netherlands licenses sales of cannabis in coffee shops. In 1978, we get ecstasy. And I'm going to stop there. There's a lot more to take in. Feel free to take a look at these two timelines I was checking out at your convenience.
So that was a timeline overview. Let's take a look at some history on specific drugs, a social history in the United States. Amphetamines were first synthesized in 1887. It became popular in the 1920s in the medical community, where it was used for raising blood pressure, enlarging the nasal passages, and stimulating the central nervous system. Abuse of the drug began during the 1930s, where it was marketed under the name Benzedrine and sold in an over-the-counter inhaler. During World War II, amphetamines were widely distributed to soldiers to combat fatigue and improve both mood and endurance. After the war, physicians began to prescribe amphetamines to fight depression. In 1962, a crackdown on San Francisco pharmacies which sold injectable amphetamines drew national attention to the problem of amphetamine mainlining. Amphetamine use began to decline in the 1970s due to increased public awareness of its dangers. That's kind of important to note, as well as FDA scheduling of the drug. During the 1990s, the popularity of crystal methamphetamine, a smokable form of methamphetamine commonly referred to as ICE, began to increase in the United States. And there are two current basic profiles of methamphetamine users: students, both high school and college, and white, blue-collar, and unemployed persons in their 20s and 30s. Cocaine is derived from the coca plant native to the Andean highlands of South America. Pure cocaine was first isolated in the mid-19th century, but its effects weren't recognized in the medical world until the 1880s. In 1883, a German army physician prescribed cocaine to Bavarian soldiers during training to help reduce fatigue. In 1884, Sigmund Freud published Uber Coca, a hymn of praise to the drug, which, along with Vin Mariani, a coca wine manufactured by a Corsican chemist, helped lead to the drug's popularization in Europe. We talked earlier about cocaine or coca leaves in Coca-Cola. In 1886, Dr. William Alexander Hammond, the Surgeon General of the U.S. Army, endorsed the medical use of cocaine at a meeting of the New York Neurological Society. Throughout the early 1900s, unregulated medicinal tonics were sold containing ingredients including cocaine and opium. By 1902, there were an estimated 200,000 cocaine addicts in the United States. Hundreds of early Hollywood silent films depicted scenes of drug use and trafficking. In 1914, the Harrison Narcotic Act outlawed cocaine in the U.S. Usage declined throughout the 40s through the 60s. In the 1970s, cocaine regained popularity as a recreational drug. Articles from the time proclaimed cocaine as non-addictive. The drug was viewed as harmless until the 1985 emergence of crack. As of 1999, Colombia remained the world's leading producer of cocaine, producing 3/4 of the world's annual yield. Crack cocaine is a free-based form of cocaine made by cooking cocaine powder, water, and baking soda until it forms a solid that can be broken down and sold in individual rocks. First appeared in large cities around 1985, where cocaine was expensive to purchase. Crack could be bought at affordable prices and became prevalent in the working class and poorer neighborhoods. In 1986 and 88, as the public furor surrounding crack increased, Congress imposed mandatory sentencing laws which dramatically increased the penalties for possessing or trafficking in crack, which was perceived to be a much more serious problem than powder cocaine. As a result, a low-level crack dealer may be subject to harsher penalties than a higher-level powder cocaine dealer. I talked about LSD some as I discussed the timeline. It was accidentally discovered and ingested by Dr. Albert Hoffman in 1943. He provided samples of the drug to psychiatrists at the University of Zurich for further testing into possible uses. In the 1950s, the U.S. military and CIA researched LSD as a possible truth drug, which could be used for brainwashing or inducing prisoners to talk. However, after military interest in LSD waned in favor of other drugs, the psychiatric community began to research and issue reports on the drug's possible therapeutic capabilities for psychotic, epileptic, and depressed patients. Non-therapeutic use of LSD increased throughout the late 50s and 60s. Among the first groups to use LSD recreationally were research study participants, physicians, psychiatrists, and other mental health professionals who later distributed the drug among their friends. The Grunsky Bill passed by Congress in 1966 prohibited the possession, manufacturing, sale, and importation of LSD. Illegal manufacturing continued despite the law. While the use of LSD declined in the 70s and 80s, the drug made a resurgence in the 90s, particularly in the rave subculture. Marijuana. Cultivation began in the United States around 1600 with the Jamestown settlers, who began growing the cannabis sativa or hemp plant for its unusually strong fiber that was used to make rope, sails, and clothing. Until after the Civil War, marijuana was a source of major revenue for the United States. Between 1850 and 1937, marijuana was widely used throughout the U.S. as a medicinal drug and could easily be purchased in pharmacies and general stores. Recreational use was limited in the U.S. until after the Mexican Revolution of 1910, when an influx of Mexican immigrants introduced the habit. The Volstead Act of 1920, which raised the price of alcohol, positioned marijuana as an attractive alternative and led to an increase in use of the drug. During the Great Depression, as unemployment increased, resentment and fear of the Mexican immigrants became connected to marijuana use. That doesn't sound familiar at all. Numerous research studies linked marijuana use by lower-class communities with crime and violence. In 1937, Congress passed the Marijuana Tax Act, which criminalized the drug. From 1951 to 1956, stricter sentencing laws set mandatory minimum sentences for drug-related offenses. In the 1950s, the beatniks appropriated the use of marijuana from the black hipsters, and the drug moved into middle-class white America in the 1960s. The increasing use of marijuana by mainstream white Americans helped lead to the Comprehensive Drug Abuse Prevention and Control Act of 1970, under which mandatory penalties for drug offenses were repealed by Congress and marijuana was categorized separately from other narcotics. The National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, NORML, was founded the same year. In the 1970s, President Carter's administration pushed for decriminalization of marijuana, with the president himself asking Congress to abolish federal criminal penalties for those caught with less than 1 ounce of marijuana. In 1986, President Reagan signed the Anti-Drug Abuse Act, reinstating mandatory minimums and raising federal penalties for possession and distribution. In 1996, California enacted Proposition 215, which legalized medical marijuana use for people suffering from AIDS, cancer, and other serious illnesses, and a similar bill was passed in Arizona the same year. And of course, recreational marijuana is now legal in a number of states. I'll get into that more later. Lastly, let's discuss opium and heroin. Opiates were popular in the United States throughout the 19th century, particularly among women. Tonics and elixirs containing opium were readily available in drugstores, and doctors commonly prescribed opiates for upper and middle class women suffering from neurasthenia and other, quote, female problems, unquote. Chinese laborers who came to work on U.S. railroads in the 1850s and 1860s brought with them the practice of opium smoking, while a San Francisco City ordinance passed in 1875 banned smoking opium within city limits. By the turn of the century, opium dens were commonplace throughout the nation. In the 1890s, tabloids owned by William Randolph Hearst published stories of white women being seduced by Chinese men and their opium to invoke fear of the, quote, yellow peril, end quote. The synthesis of morphine in 1803 led physicians to label the drug as, quote, God's own medicine, end quote, for its reliability, long-lasting effects, and safety. The mid-19th century invention of the hypodermic syringe and the use of injectable morphine as a pain reliever during the American Civil War led to the first wave of morphine addiction. In 1895, the Bayer Company in Germany synthesized heroin. Bayer began to market the drug in 1898. In the early 1900s, heroin was seen as a potential solution to the increasing problem of morphine addiction, and the philanthropic St. James Society mounted a campaign to mail free samples of heroin to morphine addicts. Heroin addiction grew. Go figure. In the second major wave of American opiate addiction, heroin was integrated into the new cultural identity of the hipster, first through the Harlem jazz scene in the 1930s and 40s, and then through the beatnik subculture of the 1950s. In April of 1971, Congressman Robert Steele investigated reports of rampant heroin abuse among U.S. servicemen in Vietnam. He estimated an addiction rate of 10 to 15%. This alarming statistic, combined with emerging evidence linking heroin addiction to crime, pushed the heroin problem to the front of Nixon's drug policy agenda. And usage of heroin increased significantly in the 1990s. So we're really seeing a kind of pattern. A drug is discovered, used for recreational and or medicinal purposes, and then somebody decides it's bad or wrong or addictive or causes health problems, and it becomes illegal. However, demand for the drug remains, and people pay a price. This is illustrated nicely by Prohibition. Now, Prohibition in the United States was a nationwide constitutional ban on the production, importation, transportation, and sale of alcoholic beverages from 1920 to 1933. It's kind of difficult to imagine life in this country without alcohol, isn't it? And there's reasons for that. Why is Prohibition relevant to our discussion about recreational drugs? Well, alcohol is a recreational drug, and it just happens to be legal. Our country went through a period where we tried to make it illegal, and it didn't work out. So I think it's important to kind of look at that and compare it to what is happening with other recreational drugs today. By 1830, the average American over 15 years old consumed nearly 7 gallons of pure alcohol a year, supposed to be 3 times as much as we drink today, and alcohol abuse, primarily by men, was wreaking havoc on the lives of many, particularly in an age when women had few legal rights and were utterly dependent on their husbands for sustenance and support. The country's first serious anti-alcohol movement grew out of a fervor for reform that swept the nation in the 1830s and 1840s. Many abolitionists fighting to rid the country of slavery came to see drink as an equally great evil to be eradicated if America were ever to be fully cleansed of sin. The temperance movement, rooted in America's Protestant churches, first urged moderation, men encourage drinkers to help each other to resist temptation, and ultimately demanded that local, state, and national governments prohibit alcohol outright. Kind of comes back to legislating morality, which, again, I believe often does not work. After the Civil War, as millions of immigrants came into our country, the brewing business boomed as German-American entrepreneurs scaled up production to provide the new immigrants with millions of gallons of beer. In the 1870s, inspired by the rising indignation of Methodist and Baptist clergymen, and by distraught wives and mothers whose lives had been ruined by the excesses of the saloon, thousands of women began to protest and organize politically for the cause of temperance. Their organization, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, or WCTU, became a force to be reckoned with. By the late 19th century, the organization could claim some significant successes. It had lobbied for local laws restricting alcohol and created an anti-alcohol educational campaign that reached into nearly every schoolroom in the nation. Its members viewed alcohol as the underlying source of a long list of social ills and found common cause with progressives trying to ameliorate the living conditions of immigrants crowded into squalid slums, protect the rights of young children working in mills and factories, improve public education, and secure women's rights. However, the goal of a prohibition amendment to the Constitution still seemed out of reach. It took the emergence of a new organization, the Anti-Saloon League, to make that happen. The Anti-Saloon League, or ASL, became the most successful single-issue lobbying organization in American history, willing to form alliances with any and all constituencies that shared its sole goal: a constitutional amendment that would ban the manufacture, sale, and transportation of alcohol. Check out the list of supporters. They united with Democrats and Republicans, progressives, populists, suffragists, the Ku Klux Klan, the NAACP, the International Workers of the World, and many of America's most powerful industrialists, including Henry Ford, John D. Rockefeller Jr., and Andrew Carnegie. Now, there's a factor that contributed to the ultimate passage of Prohibition that I didn't know about, and that was the ratification of the Income Tax Amendment in 1913. The federal government anticipated that the income tax would replace the taxes generated by liquor sales. The ASL then moved into high gear. As anti-German fervor rose to a near frenzy with the American entry into the First World War, ASL propaganda effectively connected beer and brewers with Germans and treason in the public mind. Most politicians would not defy the ASL, and in 1917, the 18th Amendment sailed through both houses of Congress. It was ratified by the states in just 13 months. Now, here's what turned out to be a major problem with Prohibition. People like their vices. They want them, and they will often pay just about any price to get them, legal or not. So while it was one thing to get Prohibition passed, enforcing it was a different matter, and there were unintended consequences. When Prohibition started on January 19, 1920, there were a few observers who predicted that it wouldn't go well. Previous attempts to outlaw the use of alcohol in American history had fared poorly. A Massachusetts town banned the sale of alcohol in 1844, but an enterprising tavern owner took to charging patrons for the price of seeing a striped pig. The drinks came free with the price of admission. That's kind of ingenious, if you ask me. When Maine passed a strict prohibition law in 1851, the result was not temperance, but resentment among the city's working class and Irish immigrant population. A deadly riot in Portland in 1855 led to the law's repeal. Now, those who supported Prohibition were surprised by what didn't happen when the law passed. Some expected sales of clothing and household goods to skyrocket. Real estate developers and landlords expected rents to rise as saloons closed and neighborhoods improved. And chewing gum, grape juice, and soft drink companies all expected growth. Theater producers expected new crowds as Americans looked for new forms of entertainment. None of that happened. Instead, the unintended consequences proved to be a decline in amusement and entertainment industries across the board. Many restaurants failed because they needed the profits from liquor sales in order to survive. On the whole, the initial economic effects of Prohibition were largely negative. The closing of breweries, distilleries, and saloons led to the elimination of thousands of jobs, and in turn, thousands more jobs were eliminated for barrel makers, truckers, waiters, and other related trades. There were more unintended consequences. One of the most profound effects of Prohibition was on government tax revenues. Before Prohibition, many states relied heavily on excise taxes and liquor sales to fund their budgets. In New York, almost 75% of the state's revenue was derived from liquor taxes. With Prohibition, that revenue was immediately lost. And at the national level, Prohibition cost the federal government a total of $11 billion in lost tax revenue, while costing over $300 million to enforce. The most lasting consequence was that many states and the federal government would come to rely on income tax revenue to fund their budgets going forward. And we're still kind of there, aren't we? It's hard to give up that source of income once you have it. Now take a moment and consider what the income might be for taxes against all recreational drugs. Just think about that. I'll probably come back to it later. Another problem with Prohibition was its legal loopholes. While the 18th Amendment prohibited the manufacture, sale, and transportation of alcohol, it did not outlaw its possession or consumption. The Volstead Act, the federal law that provided for the enforcement of Prohibition, also left a lot of loopholes and quirks. One of the legal exceptions was that pharmacists were allowed to dispense whiskey by prescription for any number of ailments, ranging from anxiety to influenza. You got the flu? What? Well, here, have a shot of whiskey. Bootleggers quickly discovered that running a pharmacy was a perfect front for their trade. As a result, the number of registered pharmacists in New York State tripled. Because Americans were also allowed to obtain wine for religious purposes, enrollments rose at churches and synagogues, and cities saw a large increase in the number of self-professed rabbis who could obtain wine for their congregations. The law was unclear when it came to Americans making wine at home. With a wink and a nod, the American grape industry began selling kits of juice concentrate with warnings not to leave them sitting too long, or else they could ferment and turn into wine. Home stills were still technically illegal, but Americans found they could purchase them at many hardware stores, while instructions for distilling could be found in public libraries in pamphlets issued by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The law that was meant to stop Americans from drinking was instead turning many of them into experts on how to make it. The trade in unregulated alcohol had serious consequences for public health. On average, 1,000 Americans died every year during Prohibition from the effects of drinking tainted liquor. But perhaps the greatest consequence of Prohibition was that of the effect on law enforcement. The sums of money being exchanged during the dry era proved a corrupting influence in both the Federal Bureau of Prohibition and at the state and local level. Police officers and Prohibition agents were frequently tempted by bribes or the lucrative opportunity to go into bootlegging themselves. Many stayed honest, but enough succumbed to the temptation that the stereotype of the corrupt Prohibition agent or local cop undermined public trust. The growth of the illegal liquor trade under Prohibition made criminals of millions of Americans. As the decade progressed, courtrooms and jails overflowed, and the legal system failed to keep up. As the backlog increased, the judicial system turned to the plea bargain to clear hundreds of cases at a time, making it a common practice in American jurisprudence for the first time. Plea bargaining, that's a whole nother topic, isn't it? I think it's not good. And finally, we can thank Prohibition for giving organized crime new levels of profitability. Before Prohibition started in 1920, members of criminal gangs in large American cities existed on the periphery of society. Since the 19th century, there was a social hierarchy with big city bosses of political machines financing their control of votes in neighborhoods with payments from criminals running gambling and prostitution rackets, and bribing police to look the other way. In cities like New York and Kansas City before 1920, the Sicilian Mafia made money through the, quote, Black Hand, unquote, racket, sending cryptic letters that demanded payments from ethnic Italians with threats of violence or death. New York's Tammany Hall political machine sanctioned gambling and brothel rackets by crime groups such as the Five Points Gang before Prohibition. But activities by the Mafia and criminal gangs generally were not coordinated under an organization, and in fact terms such as organized crime and syndicate would not enter popular use until after Prohibition began. Prohibition practically created organized crime in America. It provided members of small-time street gangs with the greatest opportunity ever, feeding the need of Americans coast to coast to drink beer, wine, and hard liquor on the sly. Organized racketeers dominated the illegal bootlegging industry. They understood banking and other legitimate business and bribed policemen, judges, juries, witnesses, politicians, and even federal prohibition agents as the cost of doing business. By the early 1920s, profits from the illegal production and trafficking of liquor were so enormous that gangsters learned to be more organized than ever, employing lawyers, accountants, brewmasters, boat captains, truckers, and warehousemen, plus armed thugs known as torpedoes to intimidate, injure, bomb, or kill competitors. Kind of sounds like what street gangs are accused of doing these days, or I suppose maybe a decade or two ago in certain parts of Los Angeles and now all over the country, really. They don't see legitimate opportunities to get out of the hood, so instead they turn their hood into something like we're talking about here. The similarities are rather striking. So why did Prohibition end? Well, the high price of bootleg liquor meant that the nation's working class and poor were far more restricted during Prohibition than middle or upper class Americans. Even as costs for law enforcement, jails, and prisons spiraled upward, support for Prohibition was waning by the end of the 1920s. In addition, fundamentalist and nativist forces had gained more control over the temperance movement, alienating its more moderate members. With the country mired in the Great Depression by 1932, creating jobs and revenue by legalizing the liquor industry had an undeniable appeal. Franklin D. Roosevelt ran for president that year, and his platform included the repeal of Prohibition. He easily beat out the incumbent, President Herbert Hoover. Once FDR won, the amendment was submitted to the states, and in December 1933, Utah provided the 36th and final necessary vote for ratification. Though a few states continued to prohibit alcohol after Prohibition's end, all abandoned the ban by 1966. So Prohibition ended because the jails were overflowing, the economy was in the crapper, and the fundamentalist movement lost a little bit of steam. Plus, they saw an opportunity for revenue to help right the economy. Yeah, I don't see how that's still relevant today. Come on now. While prohibition on alcohol has been lifted, most other recreational drugs are still illegal. I suppose it's not really a matter of what drugs you want to do, but whose. I'm quoting Todd Snyder on that one. Think about it. So if all these drugs are illegal, how much money are we as a society spending on this war on drugs? It is rather sickening. Enforcing the war on drugs costs the U.S. more than $51 billion each year, according to the Drug Policy Alliance. As of 2012, the U.S. had spent $1 trillion on anti-drug efforts. The spending estimates don't account for the loss of potential taxes on currently illegal substances, according to a 2010 paper from the Libertarian Cato Institute, taxing and regulating illicit drugs, similarly to tobacco and alcohol, could raise $46.7 billion in tax revenue each year. These annual costs, the spending, the lost potential taxes, add up to nearly 2% of state and federal budgets, which totaled an estimated $6.1 trillion in 2013. It's a large pile of change, if you ask me. Furthermore, drug enforcement spending has doubled since 2009. Arrests for drugs are increasingly high. We arrest more people for drug offenses than anything else. Annually, nearly 1.5 million people are arrested on drug charges. Okay, seriously. If that many people want to do drugs and we just keep arresting them, there is something fundamentally wrong with it being against the law. That's just a thought. Now, don't make an argument like, well, what if 1.5 million people wanted to murder someone? That's different. Okay, the taking of a life is one thing. Recreational drug use is another. Now, the effects of drug use and addiction and all those other things, I'll probably get to that at the end of my podcast. But let's return to incarceration for a minute. Roughly $80 billion is spent each year on incarcerating American prisoners. And since 50% of our prison population is serving time for drug-related crimes, that adds an additional $40 billion a year to the price tag for the war on drugs. To put this in perspective, the United States federal government allocated $154 billion for education in the 2015 fiscal year. That means that the war on drugs in this country costs the American taxpayer about half of what it costs to fund public schools, apart from state and local funding. Now, while we're talking about money and what it costs us as taxpayers, let's consider where the money goes. There's a whole industry now built up around law enforcement, right? How many jobs would be lost if drugs were legalized? Well, all these people whose careers revolve around drug enforcement would suddenly have to find something else to do. And, you know, frankly, I'm okay with that. Right now, our country has the highest incarceration rate in the world, and half of it is attributed to drug-related crimes. How's that for the land of the free? And let's not forget law enforcement's ability to seize property and money used in criminal activities. That can be kind of profitable, can't it? So the ongoing war on drugs is costing our society a great deal, but what effect would it have if we did go ahead and legalize recreational drugs? We won't really know until we get there, but we do have a few things we can look at for reference. There are states who have legalized marijuana for recreational use as well as medicinal. What has the impact been there? According to an article published on the New York Post's website on September 14, 2017, marijuana legalization has not led to more drug abuse. In fact, liberalized marijuana laws appear to have little positive or negative impact, according to a new working paper by researchers from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Harvard University, and Western Carolina University. More liberal marijuana laws have had minimal impact on marijuana use, other substance abuse, alcohol consumption, or crime rates. And there are some medicinal effects to marijuana. A 2014 study published by peer-reviewed medical journal JAMA International Medicine found the mortality rate from opioid overdoses was 25% lower in states with any kind of medical marijuana law, an effect that also grew over time. Further studies have shown evidence that marijuana and its derivatives are effective in treating epilepsy, chronic pain, and nausea associated with chemotherapy, among other conditions. But it's not all wine and roses. Other statistics show that marijuana legalization has led to an increase in traffic fatalities and hospitalizations. For instance, in the year after recreational marijuana became legal, Washington State saw double the number of traffic deaths because of drivers under the influence of the drug, according to the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety. So how do you counteract that? Education. Simple. There's a tremendous stigma for driving drunk that should be attached to driving under the influence of any kind of drug. Now, the Washington Post has an article on a report from the Drug Policy Alliance. The article is dated October 13, 2016. It says, 3 years after commercial marijuana markets first opened in Colorado and Washington, the nonprofit organization, Drug Policy Alliance, which favors marijuana legalization, acknowledges that it is too early to draw any line in the sand conclusion about the effects of marijuana legalization. But in the DPA's reading, the preliminary numbers are encouraging, and here is a summary of what the report found. Teen marijuana use is unchanged. Marijuana arrests are way down. Well, of course they are. But racial disparities remain. Long way to go there. Marijuana legalization appears to have had little impact on traffic fatalities. Kind of counteracts what I just read a bit. And tax revenues have gone up, but make up a small slice of state budgets overall. Now that's just a small sampling of the information out there about the impacts of legalized marijuana. Feel free to do your own research, but be mindful of the difference between someone's opinion and facts based on peer-reviewed research, including my opinion. Don't take my word for it. Do your own research. Okay, so let's wrap this up. Ultimately, I'm in favor of legalizing all recreational drugs. Would that cause unforeseen problems? Of course, any change in policy or any policy has that potential. How do we deal with that? Well, educate the public. Drugs often are not safe. And honestly, they're more often harmful than not. Marijuana seems to be an exception. But some people can deal with the effects and some can't. There are people who are alcoholics, and there are those who can handle just getting hammered every weekend. It doesn't have a negative effect on their life, aside from perhaps their pocketbook and maybe their liver. But I don't like the idea that some drugs are legal and some are not. Alcohol's legal, cigarettes are legal, now marijuana's legal in some states, but everything else is a no-no, and that bothers me from a freedom of choice point of view. Now, for the record, I don't do drugs. I don't drink. I've smoked pot twice in my life as a teenager to just try it. I was honestly curious. I've stopped drinking because I have a heart issue and it's a problem. I used to drink recreationally. Now, I have my weaknesses. You can see them around my waistline. I consume junk food like an alcoholic would consume beer or hard booze. That's my problem. Doesn't mean I think junk food should be illegal. In any case, if drugs were legalized, they would have to be regulated. And people would have to be made aware of all the possible side effects. I believe that. You put warnings on cigarettes, people still smoke. In fact, the cigarette industry can't advertise on television, but they have to fund anti-smoking ads because of their past crimes and or indiscretions, their past lies about their product. The cigarette industry still thrives. Why? People want to smoke. I smoked. I smoked from the time I was 12 until I turned 30. Shortly after my 30th birthday, I just sort of quit and haven't gone back. In any case, there are many sides to this issue. What exactly would be done if recreational drugs were legalized? There's a huge rat's nest of problems to consider. Medical problems, problems related to employers and health insurance and all that stuff. And I'm not going to take the time to address every issue because I don't want this podcast to run on forever. I will say that I believe it comes down to choice. Many employers currently use drug tests to eliminate potential employees. I think they should still be able to do that. I believe you, as a person, should be able to choose whether or not to do recreational drugs. I believe an employer should be able to choose whether or not to employ you if you do. And of course, there are some jobs where anyone who is found to be under the influence should be prosecuted. That's a whole nother ball of wax, but I don't want cab drivers or bus drivers or those tasked with the public safety to be under the influence while they're at work. I don't want an airline pilot drunk or high or otherwise impaired while he's flying a big metal tube. You get my point, I hope. In many ways, it all comes down to this. If you're going to indulge in any kind of recreational drug, you need to be able to handle your high. If you can't, don't do it. The issue is far more complex than that, But honestly, I think that's the essence of it. But hey, I don't pretend to have all the answers. I don't believe everything I say should be gospel. I'm not contending that I have the solution to all the world's problems, or necessarily one of them. I'm just here to state my opinion, perhaps make a compelling argument, and maybe be slightly entertaining. Ultimately, anything I say is just what I think, and I could be wrong.
That's what I think, but I could be wrong. That's what I thought when I wrote this song. I say what I believe, and I say it strong. That's what I think, but I could be wrong.
Thank you for listening. I truly appreciate it, and I'd really love a positive review on Apple Podcasts or whatever media you use to get to my show. It'll help me grow the podcast and hopefully monetize it within the reasonably near future. If you did not like the show, well, tell you what, why don't you try another episode? Maybe you'll enjoy it more. I can be reached at podcast@toddlorenz.com. My website is toddlorenz.com. You'll find this show along with all of my music. That brings us to this week's song. The choice has nothing to do with the topic. I just like this song a lot. It's called Ain't a Gonna. It was part of my 20-08 project and released on November the 10th of 2008. Thanks again for listening, and I will talk to you next week.
I drove all night just to get back home. What was waiting in my bed? My woman lying there with another man. I ain't gonna let that stand. No, I ain't gonna let that stand. I pulled my pistol and I watched him run, naked as the day he was born. I cocked the hammer and I looked at my wife. I said, you ain't a gonna live here no more. No more, no more. I said, you ain't a gonna live here no more. Said I was just a damn fool. I got so mad that I laid him out. I ain't gonna take that from you. From you, oh, from you. Oh, I ain't gonna take that from you. Well, the boss man smiled when he looked up at me. He said he knew it'd end up this way. Fired me, then he laughed when he said, you ain't gonna get no more pay. More pay, no more pay. You ain't gonna get no more pay. Stay in misery, misery, misery. I ain't gonna stay in misery. No, I ain't gonna stay in misery. No, I ain't gonna stay in misery.